Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is using new technologies to create safe marine environments. Our moderator and our first speaker tonight is Rhett Butler, who's founder and CEO with Mongo Bay. And Rhett will introduce you now to our wonderful panel and let you know what they are doing in their areas. Rhett?
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us. So we have Robin Martin from the Carnegie Institution for Science. We have Joe Mascaro from Planet. And we have David Karuzma from Global Fishing Watch. So thank you guys for being here. So to open this up, it's easy to get depressed about environmental issues, especially ocean issues these days. But there is at least one hopeful front, and that is how conservation is better leveraging technology. And so we've got a great panel here of folks who are doing just that. For one thing is we can see better than ever what's happening on the planet, so we no longer have ignorance as an excuse. I'm sure we can come up with other excuses, but that's not one anymore. So I'd like to start going through the panel here to just get a brief introduction of what you're doing. So, what's your technology, who are your users, and how is your technology or data used? So, Robin?
I'm Robin Martin. I'm at the Carnegie Institution for Science. Our Department of Global Ecology is based on Stanford campus. I'm representing the Carnegie Airborne Observatory, which is an airborne platform that images the Earth, and we do both forest and reef work. My own project is called Spectronomics, where I am doing field work on the ground to understand what underlies the imagery that we get from the airborne data. So not just that there's a forest or a reef there, but what species are made up, make up that reef or the forest or their health condition, and in hopes of eventually being able to predict before we have a bleaching or before there's a problem in the forest. Being able to do it beforehand so that we can solve problems and keep things healthy.
So you're working kind of on the ground on the science that could then inform the higher level. So like what you're doing, Joe, I mean, you're kind of at the highest level possible. So
I think there are a few orbits higher than us, but yeah, we're quite far above your head. I have a short video. I think your next slide, I can show you what Planet does. Here in the Bay Area, there's actually many different space startups, and Planet is a satellite company. We launch small satellites. You're seeing some footage of those launching right now. They're literally the size of a shoebox. And you're going to see those deploy, and they sort of tumble out of their deployers in orbit. Planet has about 150 satellites in space right now. You're actually watching 88 of them launch on a rocket February of last year of 2017. And those satellites are orbiting the Earth, and they're taking pictures of the Earth. And we actually have the capability of taking pictures approximately every day. So we image most of the land surface and most of the coral reefs of the world every single day. And this is a data source that we service for commercial entities, including agriculture companies, including governments, but also especially for scientists. And my principal role at Planet, I like to think of myself as a space ecologist, is liaising with folks like airborne ecologists like Robin and other scientists who are using our data to understand how the world is changing. And I'm really excited to be here to talk to you about that.
Thanks, Joe. And so, David, you're kind of working at the intersection of taking the science and then taking the remote sensing. So can you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah. So my name is David Kruidsma, and I run the research program at Global Fishing Watch. So Global Fishing Watch, we're an NGO dedicated to increasing transparency in the world's commercial fishing fleet. And we're using a lot of different technologies. In fact, we're using some of Planet's imagery now. But our core technology is something called AIS, or Automatic Identification System. And this is a... large ocean-going vessels are required to carry these, and what it is a little GPS and the radio that broadcasts a boat's location so the other boats nearby can pick up those signals and see where they are. So the idea is if you're on a tanker, you can see boats nearby and not collide with them. Those messages, though, go all directions and to space. And so in the last few years, a few satellite companies, much like Planet, have launched lots of small satellites that can pick up these signals and record them. And at Global Fishing Watch, we have collected a global database of, we have purchased a global database of these messages, which include the movements of about 300 to 400,000 ocean-going vessels. And we've applied a few machine learning algorithms to identify, of these few 100,000 vessels, which ones are fishing boats and when are they fishing. And if you look at the map over here, you can see this is the result of this data set. There's a few tens of billions of points since 2012 that we have processed to do this. It's a really lots of, you know, it's a pretty data intensive process. We're actually originally, I should say, a project of Google and two other nonprofits, and now we are our own nonprofit, so we come with a lot of computing power. And this shows the movements of about 60,000 in one given year fishing vessels. The animation moving across shows as it goes across one year. It's on a loop, so you're seeing the same year over and over. And the blue dots and the yellow dots are everywhere we think a boat is moving in a movement as if it is fishing. And I love this map because you can stare at this for a long time and see lots of different patterns. You know, if you look in the Indian Ocean, you can see there's this line of fishing that kind of moves up and down, and that's these long line fleet setting hooks. You can go to our website globalfishingwatch.org and look at this, and then you can look, say, if you look off the coast of Peru, you can see these vessels that are just kind of moving along the coast there, and that's a Chinese fleet that is staying right outside of Peruvian waters and fishing right along the edge. And you can look all over the world and you see other places that the boats are fishing along the edges of boundaries. And so this is a really exciting data set that you can really learn a lot about both the kind of ecology of how we fish as well as the economics and politics. And my main job is to take this data set and partner with research institutions to use it to understand, to advance knowledge of fishing in the world's oceans. And extremely exciting. I think we've had like 6 papers in just the past 2 months. We also, as an organization, are working with nonprofits and governments to use this data. You know, National Geographic Pristine is using it to identify where to put marine protected areas and so forth. Sorry, I'm going on, but it's an exciting data set with lots of uses.
Thanks, David. So you mentioned AIS. So essentially Global Fishing Watch has benefited from this existing regulatory infrastructure, but be curious to hear the panel's thoughts here on some of the enabling conditions needed to make technology work for conservation. Because sometimes when you're trying to solve a problem with technology, you have to sort of solve other issues first before you can actually apply technology as a solution. Robin, do you want to jump in on that?
Well, with the airborne data that we collect, some of our work is getting it into a form that can be used by communities on the ground. So, for example, we mapped the biodiversity of Peru and in conjunction with the Peruvian government so that they could use those data to figure out where to put a new protected area that is protecting a type of forest that doesn't have any protection. So we mapped the old protected areas onto our diversity map and then figured out where the gaps were. But the partnership with Peru has been 9 years. Took 9 years to develop their ability to use our data. So we, over that time period, learned the other direction of how to simplify our data without losing its science, so that they could use the data. So we've been partnering with other governments and also NGOs and a number of people to facilitate their needs. So it's very much a partnership, not just make the data and give it, you know, sell it or give it out or anything like that. We're a very project-driven organization. So work in collaboration with people.
Yeah, I think on the space side, you know, the regulatory landscape is complex. I mean, I will say, first of all, the Planet has had a great partner in the U.S. government, including NASA and NOAA and many of the other agencies that that regulate space activities. And, you know, you're seeing increasingly huge number of sensors deployed in space. So not just Planet satellites. There's another company in San Francisco called Spire, which does radio occlusion signals, data set that goes into Global Fishing Watch. There's also a geostationary orbiting company that's interested in putting satellites up into geostationary orbit. These are telecom satellites called Astranis. And there's a huge nonlinear increase in the number of satellites being launched, and there's also a nonlinear increase in their capabilities. And so you're definitely dealing with a technological landscape where the technology is advancing very rapidly, and I think we're excited that the regulations are moving, I think, at pace. But certainly when it comes to collecting data for purposes of understanding how the Earth is changing generally, scientists are dealing with regulatory infrastructure. Drones, airborne drones, are a very good example. In the United States, it's relatively difficult to operate a science drone platform. And many scientists working with drone platforms are working outside the United States because it's simply easier to operate. And so I think another good example would be autonomous vehicles, right? We're seeing autonomous vehicles being tested, and the regulations are essentially trying to keep up because the technology is moving so rapidly. So I think we're going to expect a lot of nonlinear, unpredictable outcomes.
Yeah, and in Global Fishing Watch, we've benefited from basically countries regulating that they have to have AIS on vessels. So if you look back at the beginning of our data set in 2012, you see almost no fishing vessels with AIS. That's because that wasn't regulated. And then suddenly in 2013, all these Chinese vessels pop out of nowhere, as do half of the European fleet. And what happened is, was the regulations. In 2016, the US regulated it on boats over 65 feet. And so that used to be larger. And then you see all these other boats appear. So every year we're seeing more and more. But I think that really is in conjunction with the technology that you really can't, I think, stress enough that what you see on our map was not possible 5 years ago because we didn't have all these satellites up there. Like those hundreds of satellites you saw launched by Planet, those are the same other ones are up there by Spire and up there by Orbcomm that are the companies are giving us our AIS data. And then also, in addition to that, we didn't have as good of machine learning technology as we do now. Think of all that. It's basically the same type of technology that Facebook uses to identify what your friend's face is. But we use it on identifying phishing behavior. So those new technologies are really kind of leaped us ahead. And then, of course, you need on-the-ground regulations to make it possible.
So you just mentioned looking back 5 years. I mean, did Planet's constellation launched 2000, the big launch in 2014?
We actually started, so I believe we launched our first CubeSats in 2014. I might be able to correct me on that. I myself joined the company in late 2014, so there were some satellites flying already. But just in 2017, we deployed more than 150 satellites in a single calendar year. There were nearly, I think, around the order of 200 Earth observation satellites deployed in 2017, so the majority of those were launched by Planet. But again, across the whole landscape, you are seeing this nonlinear increase. So there's an increasing number of government-sponsored Earth observation sensors, and of course, an increasing number of other types of satellites that aren't necessarily observation satellites. There are some industry trends underlying that. One is the cost of sending things to space is dropping. So I'm sure, like me, many of you have been dazzled by watching SpaceX land reusable first stages of their Falcon 9 down at Cape Canaveral and Vandenberg Air Force Base. There are many other rocket companies as well, and I won't go through all the names, but there is a renaissance, actually, some of our colleagues at Planet call it, in terms of space technology. I think Bloomberg just called it the new space age. Now, keep in mind, this is just 7 years after The Economist published an article about the end of the space shuttle and called it the end of the space age. So, these things go in fits and starts, but I think it's unequivocal that we're in a genuine revolution in the space industry, and you're seeing it in terms of rockets, spacecraft, and capabilities. Many of the other technologies that are being mentioned, they're also related to two other major revolutions. One is in storage, in terms of data storage and compute capabilities. So you have firms like Google and Amazon now that can store and process reams of data, unprecedented amounts of data. And just like you interact with those cloud storage devices or banks when you are working with Facebook or Twitter, scientists are increasingly interacting with those cloud storage database primarily as the primary way that they interact with remote sensing data or other types of data technology. And that is fundamentally new. So, 20 years ago, you would download individual Landsat images, not even download them. You would have to get them. You'd have to buy them from NASA. And they cost something like $600 per scene, and they would send them to you in the mail. And it was just impractical to analyze these huge volumes of data. And then the third one I would mention is the algorithmic revolution. So the kinds of machine learning that's being deployed, just as David said, when you're tagging your cats, those algorithms are powering your ability to find ships that are behaving in a particular way, a trawling signal. Literally, the movement of a ship might have a particular pattern, and that pattern might look just like a cat in ship speak, right? Versus a different type of shipping approach that might look like a dog. And so all these revolutions are kind of converging, and we're just experiencing an explosion of data in science.
So Robin, how has your work changed in the past 5 years?
Our work has changed dramatically in that we feel compelled to speed it up so that instead of only having algorithms finding the patterns that we're actually, as ecologists, finding the patterns from data that we collect on the ground. So not necessarily just we do collect data right under the airborne systems, but also understanding the relationships of the signal that you're getting from the air. So our system, many of the satellites only give you, well, for Planet, for example, is basically like a camera in space with red, green, and blue. Our instrument measures 255 colors, give or take. So you can imagine how much more data you get from that system, and we also measure at a much higher resolution because we're on an airborne, the spatial resolution because we're flying. That said, getting an airplane into different country takes a whole lot of work, and actually being able to fly it and collect the data takes a lot of work. So we've been working hard, partners with people like Planet or other people, trying to link our airborne data to the satellite data. So in the lab, that's often part of our work is to inform the satellite data. And then my work on the ground also informs the airborne data. So it's sort of steps up.
So in terms of, you're doing everything from collecting samples in the trees and in the coral reefs, and then having that inform the airplane-based system, which then can inform Planet and other systems.
Correct.
Essentially. But you've also had another major shift in the past 5 years, which is you've moved from terrestrial ecosystems to oceans. So you might want to, that would be kind of interesting to tell people about. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah. So yes, we've spent a lot of years on the ground in the jungle and come to the ability to basically map biodiversity of forests in tropical forests, not just in northeast U.S. But so that through learning how to do that, then we are taking those data and that knowledge and then applying it to coral reefs. So looking at the spectral data, so the high density of image data that we can get, and rather than just looking at a white reef, trying to understand the differences between the species there and how they might be coming up into the image data. So how their signals.
So you're generating a lot of data. You're generating a lot of data. We're all generating a lot of data. So it seems like that would be a significant bottleneck. Is that correct with these various systems of having to process all this data coming in every day?
Well, like I was talking about with this cloud storage and compute. So just to highlight, like Google, for example, other firms are doing this too, but Google has co-located storage and compute. So you can do something with say Google Earth Engine, which is you can think of it like the garage lab equivalent of Google Earth, right? So instead of just looking at the Earth, the scientists that use Earth Engine can play with it and get into the guts of the data. They can go in and take something like the entire Landsat record. So this runs back to the early 70s. And decide that they want to apply an algorithm and analyze that Landsat record. And they can apply and analyze that algorithm on the entire Landsat record from the 70s all the way to today in seconds for the entire world. And this is served to them over a browser. So it's a web tile service, meaning that even if you're a user in a place like Bangladesh where your bandwidth might be pretty tight, as long as you've written the code well and you're able to debug it and send off these commands to Google, the script going to Google that's a tiny amount of traffic. All the processing and the real guts of it is happening on Google's clusters. Planet actually uses Google storage and compute too. So we pull down something like, I don't have the exact number. I think it's on the order of 6 terabytes a day from space, from our satellite constellation. And just in terms of pre-processing, so taking that data from a format that's sort of like raw off the sensor and converting it into a usable, we now in the industry refer to this as analysis-ready data. So this is a data feed where you've co-registered all these different types of data sets, and you've kind of pre-processed them to the point where it's not quite point and click, but it's to the point where you can now apply generalized algorithms on the data. And because, again, all that is happening with cloud storage and compute, you don't have the burden necessarily of picking and choosing where you would do it. You experiment, you get your code to work, you kind of optimize it, but then you can kick off jobs and analyze the whole world right at your laptop. I mean, even a Chromebook, practically. So.
Yeah. So I guess also when you get this data, like what's the next step?
One thing I think that's nice, I think we should step back about, we have this incredible amount of data, but one thing that's really struck me about working in the ocean is actually how little data there is, right? And I want to actually hear from Robin what it's like going from the forest to reefs, if you've experienced that, because it's amazing for me. If you go to globalfishingwatch.org and look at our global map of fishing effort, we had no idea what was going on in the middle of the ocean almost just a few years ago. And also now I'm now working with researchers who are taking our maps and trying to line them up with the ranges of different species. And I'm like, oh, well, you should just get like the map of where tuna are. And that map is not very good. And you look at feature after feature in the high seas, and it's just not good data. And so what's amazing to me is how much even just a little bit improves things. And now we're not just throwing a little bit at it. We're throwing, a constellation of satellites at this thing we've never looked at before. And it's really, I think, the transparency revolution on the ocean through this technology is just an enormous change to the way we manage marine resources.
So, I mean, just to follow up on that. So how is it different between forests and oceans? From what you've found so far.
There's a whole different set of parameters that one has to deal with, layers of water. That said, given the advances that we made over the forest in atmospheric correction and that sort of thing, they are helping us immensely in dealing with the next steps of doing the water corrections and all that so that you can really see the reef underneath. Another one of the big advances of the Airborne Observatory is that it's not just the imager, it's an imager plus a LIDAR so that we have very accurate knowledge of exactly where we're getting our image from. So that helps a lot in these sort of identification types of analyses. You're not worried about co-location and things as much as you are, say, with satellites or other instruments. So that really helps when you're trying to look more deeply into the function and the health of the reef or the forest.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is using new technologies to create safe marine environments. And our speaker and moderator tonight and founder is Rhett Butler. And I'm actually going to ask Rhett a question or two. I remember when you came to a program here at the Commonwealth Club, and it was the first time that I heard that you used beat-up iPhones and put them in trees. And I actually have carried that story around ever since I first heard it. So could you share with the audience of that? That had an amazing impact on me about what you could find by using something that was, in our viewpoint, out of date for a while, for one reason.
Sure, yeah. So there's a really great organization called Rainforest Connection, and they are taking used cell phones and mounting them in trees. And basically they have code on that just listens for certain sounds. So chainsaws, gunshots, car engines, and they just sit there listening. And they have like a solar array around them. So it's low power. And they just basically sit there. And because they're high in the canopy, you can be 30 kilometers away from the nearest cell phone tower. And so if one of the phones has a connection, then it creates like a mesh network so they can talk to each other. But what it does is it creates real-time alerts. So, you know, Planet has great data, but it's still there's a lag time. This can actually allow you to intervene as someone's turning on a chainsaw. So it's really exciting.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I have another question for Rhett, because I actually remembered it too. You probably think I forget these things. And that was, I've always been drawn to oceans, and we've talked about oceans. We seem to talk about them technically, as far as I am concerned. But we're talking about health in oceans and coral reefs. And on top of our bottom, it's probably the bottom, we don't talk very much about fuels and what our fuels are like now for these ocean-going discoveries. And we really don't say how we're going to do this in terms of fuels and keeping ocean boats and ships going on the ocean because of having good fuels. How are we going to do it?
Well, that's really true. So a lot of the traditional fuels used in ocean-going vessels are very dirty. It sounds like there is a lot of innovation happening there, because you have sort of this built-in, inertia, it's going to take quite a while to actually adopt. But there is a lot of potential with renewables obviously you have wind, but wind's only going to get you so far. But I think there's a long way to go, but at least there is stuff happening now. And I think also a lot of the land-based communities are putting pressure on shipping in the shipping industry in terms of their emissions, so creating particulate matter and things like that. So I think that's an added pressure that's very important.
Because basically, dirty fuels are dirty oceans and dirty coral reefs, and I guess that's why I'm so interested. If we can't get that going on a faster track, that's just a wish that I have. So perhaps we'll be able to do that. And I'll turn that back now to Rhett and his group, and Rhett will be our moderator for our group.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Anne. So Anne actually raised a good question, and that is, once we have this data, what do we do with it? If it's a Landsat image and we're getting it, at a once a month or something, it makes it hard to actually have interdiction. So, let's get into this a little bit. So what do you do once you have this data? Like, who uses it, or, how do you use it?
Yeah. I'll relate a quick story from forests and then one from the ocean. So, early in my time at Planet, we had some imagery over southern Peru that captured some illegal mining activity. And with some partners in Peru, we were able to confirm that mining activity was unequivocally illegal. Basically, people had infiltrated into a national park boundary. And this group in Peru, it's called the Amazon Conservation Association, shared that data with journalists and government ministers in Peru. This was the important linkage. That is to say, there was a linkage between a data source, an actor, this being a nonprofit entity, but then people who are capable and have the means to take action. And they actually went in and destroyed some illegally sited mining equipment. Now, unfortunately, there is still some mining activity happening. And then the oceans, we do have a great example a few years ago of basically a tip from an AP reporter that resulted in a single high-resolution Digital Globe Image, another satellite company, that basically caught a slave ship, of basically indentured servants working for months over the open ocean. And if I could just tie that together, that what's happening there is now you have people with local knowledge, and in this case, a particular reporter. I think here with this massive amount of data, the real switch that we have on the horizon is an automated or semi-automated way of socializing that kind of actionable information and getting it into the right hands. And so instead of isolating one ship because of local knowledge, you do something like Global Fishing Watch is doing. You integrate many different data sources, and then you farm out those different events and then look at them and figure out which ones have nefarious activity going on.
And I believe that story you're talking about was actually one of my colleagues at SkyTruth working with Global Fishing Watch,
yeah,
tracking that boat in AIS, communicating with Digital Globe where to take the picture, and that was really exciting. One of the things I want to talk about in addition to like the rapid response type of work, which I think is really exciting and a good thing to enable, and also the type of catching, you know, of pointing out nefarious activity and communicating that. One of the other things that I'm really excited about working about, what we do with the data, is how you turn it into useful knowledge and information, mm-hmm, which then, that's a longer time scale, right? It leads to longer kind of policy work and whatnot and how we manage things. But one of the things I've discovered in my work is there's a lot of people out there who are world experts in marine policy, marine economics, and marine biology that don't have in-house data science labs like we have. And so a huge part of my job is taking all this data processing and kind of linking it up with the world experts in these fields so then they can take it and turn it into useful knowledge. And that's been incredibly satisfying for my work, because there's all this, that's our huge challenge. How do we turn data into knowledge? And you have to do that through partnerships of people who can do both parts.
Yeah, I mean, so we at Manga Bay as journalists, we use Planet quite a lot, but we also used the Carnegie Institution's science, essentially. Yep. We something popped up on a satellite. We looked at Planet to kind of zoom in on it, and then we could use your data, Carnegie's data, to show the history of that land and the fact that it was very biodiverse. So essentially, yep, your spectronomics work could show that this is a biodiverse rainforest, not the degraded land that the company was claiming. Right. So that was quite valuable.
Yeah, and there's two things our data can do, and one is to, yes, make the map and help locate new protected areas, but also in the coral reef world, we're working on really trying to understand what are the signals for bleaching before it actually happens. So not just watching the temperature of the ocean get hotter and hotter, and then does that lead to bleaching and sort of all this guesswork that sometimes goes on, but actually having images of the corals themselves and understanding their physiological change that we may be able to see in our data. So we're working on that type of methods to predict what might happen or what's susceptible. What are the most susceptible places, rather than just guessing.
And in terms of the mechanics of that, you would be applying an algorithm to the data that you've collected?
Yeah, so we have the spectra and then the chemical changes in the coral samples that I take and link those together. So looking at the changes, so what might look like a healthy coral, they're just very, very minute signals of what's happening that you can pick up in the spectroscopy with the airborne data that shows you that they've been resistant or resilient from previous bleaching. And so we've been able to find that in the data. So in Kaneohe Bay, they've tracked bleached and unbleached corals, and there have been two bleaching events, and some of the corals have recovered, and we can find those just as you fly over. We can find those corals that have recovered, even though they look like their neighbors that never bleached. So
work.
So you can have this predictive model, but you can also sort of establish baselines for measuring change.
And that's what we're doing in a lot of different places, working in the Dominican Republic. The CAO just flew there, and they're trying to establish marine protected areas there, and in Belize also.
So that could be a way to measure conservation impact in a way.
Right.
And so I would assume a planet could be used for that as well. You can start to see how long-term trends.
That's a great scientific question. I think we don't know whether planet data could do that. It's probably going to be tough for planet to predict bleaching before it happens. Robin mentioned this before. So our sensors in space, they actually image in 4 spectral bands. So that means we see visible light and also near-infrared light just outside of the visible spectrum. But by linking with CAO, where you have, I forgot the number, but you have hundreds of spectral bands where it's almost like getting a fingerprint of the electromagnetic spectrum, right? This technology can be used to identify even individual coral species, which we right now cannot do from space. We'd have to get different types of sensors in space to do that. But the interesting part would be if you could potentially correlate those two data sets, and it would be a research question. I'm not suggesting you could see a pre-indicator of bleaching. We do think you're likely to be able to see bleaching correlated in both those data sets, which means that you can take the limited aircraft footprint of something like Carnegie Airborne, where you have a limited number of places on the Earth where you can look, and you can translate that out to the globe where you can monitor every day and then see potentially the bleaching in real time. Again, you're not likely with present technology with planet sensors to be able to see it, to be able to predict it. But we think we're likely to be able to see it and track it around the Earth.
And that's what we did on land in the forest, was take Landsat data and sort of train it with the much higher fidelity, higher spatial and spectral resolution, so that you could better predict things based on these broad, very few bands that you get from the Landsat satellite data. So you could distribute a biodiversity map across the entire country of Peru.
Can I just, I want to make a quick analogy on this technology, because I think other folks here might be reading and thinking about different types of technology, and they're actually quite analogous. So when Robin and David and others are working either in the field or from the air, there's often this situation where you have a limited number of observations. There's just a limited number of people you can put in the water in dive suits to put spectrometers right on a reef. With autonomous vehicles, for example, we're dealing with kind of a similar situation where you're increasingly equipping vehicles with lots of sensors. And in principle, you could equip all vehicles with autonomous sensors, right? But there's also an open question as to whether you also need land-based, more limited sensors. So you might be interested in putting out sensors in an urban environment that would also see vehicles and be able to talk to each other. In agriculture, the satellite data from tractors is being intersected with individual point data loggers. They're kind of like the cell phone project you were doing in forests, where you have basically an isolated data point on the ground, but you put out thousands of those, maybe tens of thousands of those. And in aggregate, you can learn something from those individual data observations.
And I feel like this is all, again, just emphasizing how much more data we have on the land
and
the ocean. I'm like, we have, so it's...
Well, you guys do have AIS signals.
We do have AIS,
but that's vehicles only, don't put out.
That's only tens of thousands of vessels. There's actually, FAO estimates 2.8 million motorized fishing vessels in the world.
Right.
Most of them are very small. We see the really big ones. We see it's a significant amount of the world's catch, but we're missing all those little ones. And so what's amazing to me is we don't even know. And I've looked at these numbers a lot that are published from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, the number of fishing vessels in the world, and I don't believe any of them. There's a lot of uncertainty. I shouldn't say that. People work very hard to compile them, but they're all coming from different countries who have different methodologies, and the uncertainty, I was actually wondering, what's our uncertainty in the number of trees in the world, plus or minus?
Well, it depends which one of those papers you read.
It depends if you find tree, right?
Yeah. Right. Anyway. But anyway, there's just a very large amount of uncertainty in just how many boats, and you can count boats. That's something we should know, of how many fishing vessels are operating. So, you know, and I think we're talking about predicting, you know, predicting coral bleaching is great, but just describing it, just getting that first picture, I think is really important.
So David, looking at 5 years, will we have better ways to count those vessels that aren't part of AIS?
Yes, once Planet images the entire ocean, then it is coming. So there's a few things that are happening at once for vessels in the ocean. So go back 5 years. The map you see here on globalfishingwatch.org doesn't exist. You basically don't know where things are. Now we can track all of the large fishing vessels somewhat in real time. With Planet imagery, we've started to do this. So Planet is currently imaging off of all of the world's coastlines, but not only a few places in the high seas, and that's in the future. Right. So we can go along. We've started doing this using a machine learning algorithm to count boats. And you can still only count, you can't count the small boats with this, with current Planet imagery at scale, but you can basically take the whole world's coastline right now, if we had time, and count all of the large vessels along the coastline. And we're also using, you can also do this with radar. We're doing some things with Google Earth Engine, where you can count every single human object along the coastlines. And so what's going to happen, I think, in 5 years, that'll turn into almost real-time ability to just see where every man-made object on the ocean is. And I think that will lead, you know, and I think that it'll be as much or more leap forward from where we are now than from where we are now compared to 5 years ago.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Robin, where do you think things will be for you in 5 years?
We are hoping that they will be in space in 5 years. I think there'll still always be a need for aircraft data to understand what's going on, but I think that there's hope that we will get at least a fairly good multi-spectral instrument in space.
You sound like you're almost eulogizing field work, but don't. So this is going to date me very badly, but if you guys remember the original Jurassic Park, so Steven Spielberg, right? You have a scene there where they send a sonar pulse down and they see a skeleton, and a grad student quips something like, "A few more years development, we won't have to dig anymore." And Alan Grant says, "Where's the fun in that?" And I actually, despite the fact that I've been increasingly working more remotely from the object of interest throughout my career, I started as a forest ecologist measuring trees by hand. I worked with Greg and Robin measuring them from the air, and now I measure them from space. I mean, if I start measuring them from Mars, you guys should worry. But I actually don't, I do not believe we will ever see the end of learning about things by touching and feeling and looking at them, because there's just... there are non-substitutable things to learn.
Right.
I would even say that there's also the occlusion of the atmosphere. You know, the current commercial restriction on remote sensing imagery from space for entities regulated in the United States is 25 centimeters. Nobody actually sells data this. The closest is 31 centimeters, but that means they can sell you a pixel that's basically this big. It's a little smaller than your laptop. And I don't know what the spy satellites get to, but it's probably a little bit better than that. But there would be a point, actually, where the atmosphere physically occludes your ability to do things. Even if you have a huge telescope, a ridiculous telescope, you're not going to see, you're not going to see the coral animals actually living in the reef, right? That's not going to happen from space. The technology you're going to run into physical limits of technology. So interacting these data sets, I think, will always be something we're doing in science.
And it's the analogous, the problem that we have, you know, is you need that ground truth thing to train your models. So this was a huge problem when we wanted to say when those boats are fishing based on how they are moving. And ideally, what you need is logbooks from vessels saying we were fishing at this point this time, and then you tell your model, okay, the boats are fishing on these hours, these times, and these times. So, however, whenever you get these logbooks, you realize that they're not in the same place the boat says it is, and often the error rate on it is enough that you can't actually train your models on them. And so what we had to do on a lot of these was actually use expert opinion based on how the vessels are moving and look at them that way. But there's lots of other things where we really need that ground truth data, and it's really hard to get, and that's one of the bottlenecks.
Great, thanks, David. I think we have an announcement.
Our program tonight is using new technologies to create safe marine environments. Our moderator tonight is Rhett Butler, and we have the time now. We're coming to that time for our audience questions, and Rhett has those questions, and he'll ask them of the panel, and if anyone wants to raise their hand and give a short statement in the audience, please do, because we can always bring that into our conversations. But let's start with our audience questions.
Great. Thanks, Anne. So first question for the panel, what do folks think of what will be the next big technology to benefit marine conservation efforts? David, I'll start with you.
Well, for us, the thing we're focused on, I think the next exciting thing is, as I was saying it before, is ability to see dark targets. So things that are not broadcasting their locations, and being able to not only see them, but track them in almost real time from satellites. And so that you can really get a sense of, you know, where people may be fishing where they shouldn't be, or really how much fishing activity is actually happening. I think that's one of the things I'm most excited about.
Just follow up on that. There's another question on this. What happens when fishers turn off their AIS now?
Well, then we can't track them. but it's, sorry, that's kind of not. Well, you can tell when they turn it off, right? And so, because you can see they lose their signal.
And then you can see it pop up somewhere
else. And you see it pop up somewhere else. And there's been some analyses of these done, and some of it indicates suspicious behavior. And I think that the interesting thing, actually, I think, is not just the technology, but really the cultural shift. Because it used to be that, oh, where I'm fishing is like where my movements are private. You think we're tracking all these vessels. And this is what's changed, is that people now accept that this information should be public. And actually, we do some things where we keep the little bit of privacy. We publish the data 3 days delayed, so you can't actually see where you're fishing on that day. And that's actually of some value to fishers, because they want to keep their location on that day secret, but a few days later or a week later is actually not as valuable. But anyway, so there's been this change in mentality around transparency. And if you go to globalfishingwatch.org and you look at our map, you can see there's around Indonesia, we have all this data. On the map here, it's in yellow. That's actually not the same AIS. That's Indonesia's vessel monitoring system, which is the country's system for monitoring fishing vessels. And actually, every country has this system, almost every country, for monitoring a large part of their fishing fleet. And usually it's totally top secret. Like, you cannot get the US VMS data, because it is, you know, you can't even grid it on a map very easily. But because of this, because we're making it available, now Indonesia has decided, you know what, this is worth it. We're going to give our data to Global Fishing Watch to publish for free. And we're talking already with some other countries. Peru has announced they will do the same, and several other countries are talking about it as well. So I think there's this attitude towards transparency, which is really enabling a lot of this as well. And it makes sense. It's a public resource they're taking from the oceans. It's not like this is private activity. Those fish belong to everyone before they're taken out of the sea. There's no reason that should be private.
Do either of you guys want to give your thoughts on the next big technology breakthrough?
I might mention yet another data source that's probably coming. So, and yet another Bay Area tech company just across the bay is a company called SailDrone, which is making a fleet of autonomous sailing vessels. So these have good fuel, and these are powered by the wind. And one of the things they're able to do, so this is similar to the type of research that NOAA would historically collect, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, but they have a limited number of vessels they can do it from. Saildrone can start actually collecting real-time data on schools of fish. So they can see certain types of fish. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what they produce. They've got, I think, about 50 vessels. You can see one of them over at the Exploratorium. These are something like 50-foot long sailing vessels that are going to be collecting data autonomously by sailing around the oceans for months at a time. Pretty amazing.
All right, I've got more. Yeah. So this has come up a few times. Sort of the implications of misusing technology, which kind of gets into privacy. Like, is there a downside to this vastly increased transparency? Like, could a fisherman jump on this and say, "Oh, well, that's." I know that's tuna fishing, so I'm going to go there or something like that, or where to mine in the rainforest.
Well, I think that is one of the sensitivities. So an example with mapping the forest diversity, you know, some governments worry when we're going to make these maps, then is that going to show foresters where the best forest is so they can go chop that down? So you do have to have a balance there. I think for the most part, it gives the government power to know where they need to protect, so it isn't as worrisome of a problem as it could be. But there definitely, that does come up with our data in forests, and I'm not sure yet with reefs. We have to see how well things map out, and but yeah, that could be a potential problem.
And that's it's a problem if there isn't, I mean, if the government, if the regulations if there isn't some type of policy that backs it up or acts on it, or right,
or manpower to actually follow up on
right.
protecting it,
right, or the enforcement,
yeah.
If that's not there, then it's a problem, and it that obviously varies by country. And in the oceans, it's a huge problem. So right now, actually, they're just starting negotiating a new treaty for how to manage the high seas. And the high seas is everywhere, more than 200 nautical miles from the coastlines of countries. And that is currently owned by no country. And so it is currently not, it's very difficult to manage. And so I think that's somewhere that you could see that maybe potentially being more of a problem, all this transparency actually helping to increase exploitation. But the hope is that this better information can instead power better cooperation and management. But it's up to us. It's not just going to automatically happen because we have all this information.
Joe, a question for you. What about space conservation? What happens when there are too many satellites around the Earth, and what happens to those sensors when they lose energy?
Great question. It's actually a question that speakers from Planet get asked nearly every time we talk. So a couple of quick things on that. One, I would say that regulations are getting really good on this. So for example, Planet is required to, and all US-based space satellite providers are required to deorbit their satellites within 25 years. It means you need to carry the fuel to fly them back to Earth and basically burn them up in the atmosphere, or they need to naturally deorbit by virtue of having such a low orbit. And it is in those low orbits where Planet operates. So our spacecraft, when they re-enter the atmosphere, and they do, many of them have already, they burn up completely in the atmosphere. I would just briefly mention, if you guys are really interested in space debris, there's a fabulous piece that was done by 60 Minutes about a couple of years ago. The Air Force tracks objects in space. They track, basically, I might get these numbers wrong. I believe, my recollection is something like 60,000 objects as big as a grapefruit or bigger, and something like 2,000 or so are satellites under power. And it sounds like a lot. And it's definitely an important issue, and it's a serious issue. But I would also say, if I told you there were 60,000 grapefruits floating in the ocean, and then I said, go find one, you know, space is really big. And so I think we got a lot of time to figure out this problem. But certainly all the satellite providers are conscientious actors when it comes to making sure that we comply with those regulations to keep those orbits clean.
There are a couple of questions that touched on, I would call them gaps. So one is about the animations on the wall. You know, do those reflect biological productivity patterns? You know, what stories do they tell us about fisheries and fish populations? And then another one is, what about the other 99% of the ocean that isn't on the surface, you know, deeper than 30 meters? I'll throw those out there, or other gaps that are in this space.
Sorry, what was the first one?
First one is, does that show essentially biological productivity in some way? What story does it tell us about fish populations and fishing practices?
Yeah, so it does basically tell you where there are fish that you can catch, which makes a lot of sense. A lot of the stuff, so most fish are caught close to shore. That's where the most productive ecosystems in the ocean are. But you see a lot of fishing out in the high seas, and that's mostly tuna fish as well as types of billfish and shark fishing as well. But most of the fishing close to shore. What's exciting about this is we have research projects to be able to answer that question right now of can you guess what the fish population is each year based on how hard the vessel is fishing? And we found that in some places you can. And that's really exciting because that's much cheaper to just analyze our data to make that estimate than to have to do an expensive stock assessment. Still in the very nascent stages, but that's a possibility, I think, in the future that we'll be able to do a lot of this type of managing of fish populations through that type of data.
What would reflect subsurface biomass for the fish?
So subsurface biomass. It's really hard to see below 30 meters. So an interesting fact is that most of the fish we think of as fish are live in that area that we can see. And there's actually several times the amount of fish biomass in the ocean that's below actually 1,000 feet. It's actually very strange, but that's just not, I think that's a longer way away before we can monitor that. Some places, yeah.
So
that's true.
We have a question about resources. So Global Fishing Watch is a nonprofit, Chasing Impact. Planet is a for-profit supporting groups like Global Fishing Watch. By the way, if I say Global Forest Watch, I apologize. I do a lot with Global Forest Watch. So how do we make sure that ocean groups like Global Fishing Watch keep getting the data they need without getting priced out? And so I think that also ties in with just data accessibility, I think, which is, increasing data doesn't necessarily mean increasing access to data. So can we talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I would say, actually my day-to-day role at Planet is director of academic programs. One of the things I'm very proud that we do is we actually grant a limited amount of non-commercial access to Planet's CubeSat data, the SmallSat data, to anyone at a university. And we've had a number of people use our data for scientific research purposes, including for certain marine applications. For larger projects, we are looking for collaborators, and we've found great collaborators in places like Global Fishing Watch, in places like the Carnegie Airborne Observatory. I think that you're going to, now speaking just across the industry, you're going to increasingly see entities, including commercial for-profit entities like Planet, compete in what is a global stewardship landscape. And in order for us to compete in that landscape, that means we've got to do that through partnerships that move a lot of data into the hands of people that can take action.
And I will add on that it is... So we're blessed to have started as a partnership with Google, and so able to have some help with the computing resources because of that. But the biggest bottleneck is getting to be able to get your data scientists, be able to pay data scientists to work on this instead of working on clicking on ads. and so how to make that better. Anyway,
yeah. So just, I mean, kind of on this theme, how can people in Silicon Valley help with your efforts?
Well, for the Carnegie Airborne Observatory, that's all private funds or, U.S. funding, federal funds, but not very much anymore. And as I said in the beginning, we are very driven by partnerships and knowing that, because the funds are so limited for Carnegie, we sort of have to know that our project's going to have an outcome that is useful. To have contributions that would free that up a little bit to maybe, offer some services where that partner might not have any funds to help contribute to the project. So that would be helpful for us to be able to expand our technology, you know, our technology to other places.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. I want to let our radio audience and listeners know what a beautiful global map we have tonight. We actually have one in each part of the room, and they're just stunning. And I want to thank those who... Is there someone in the audience who was part of doing the global maps? Or they're not going to admit to it. Is that it? But for our radio audience, it is an incredible global map. And I'm glad that our audience here and in those who have a visual part, visual copies, that they can see it and hope that the radio audience can kind of dream all of the blues and the greens and everything else.
You just have to go to globalfishingwatch.org and you too can see it.
David very strategically orchestrated this. This animated map has been running the entire presentation. Very clandestinely slipped it in as the last slide.
And he did not know that I was going to say, I didn't know I was going to say this until I saw the map. So this is really something that came forward.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I want to talk about it because I think there is something. I want to talk a little more before we finish. I want to talk a little more about the communications aspect of things. I think it is so exciting to see some of this stuff for the first time. First, I want to answer that question though about how people can help us. The first is, of course, I think as Robin said, funding. Doing things for good. You know, we're foundation supported. We're not making a profit. And so that relies on funders realizing the social benefit of what we're doing and supporting it. The second is working for us or volunteering. So I always tell people that people are thinking about working on data science, and I know there's a lot of people like that in the Bay Area, that you should work on environmental data science. And these are the reasons. First, there's a lot of data, and it's super interesting. It's spatial. You can make pretty maps like that. It's really, really fun. Second, it's really socially important. You'll be working on something that matters. And then third, there's not much money in it. And because there's not much money in it, it's really easy to make discoveries, okay? You're not going to make a better ability to click on an ad than somebody else because someone else has already been paying $1 million to do that. But you can take this map of fishing and be the first person in the world to see it. And that's what it's like working at Global Fishing Watch and why you should come volunteer for us if you're a data scientist.
It's sad that we have reached that point in our program for our last question. So, Rhett, what is your last question?
Oh, that was actually how people in Silicon Valley could help. But do you have one more thing to say? Or I thought you were going to spring a question on me. So,
I would second David. I mean, Planet's speaking from the for-profit side. We're actually hiring as well. So, and we are, believe it or not, at planet.com. I mentioned that those at universities can get free access to a lot of our data. Even if you're not at a university, you can come explore data for the state of California, and that includes the coastline of California. So you can create a trial account at planet.com right now. And I would also just say, speaking on behalf of I think the whole industry in the Bay Area, places like Saildrome, places like Planet, places like Spire, I'm really excited that we're increasingly hiring talent out of especially our own California universities to do things that are a little bit more beneficial to the world than tagging cats in images. I think it's really important. And I think you're seeing increasingly really high-powered talent coming out of some of our most sterling universities like Stanford and Berkeley, but many different universities around the world, where people graduate and they simply, they really want to make a difference. And it's not a question of whether they want to work at a nonprofit or a for-profit or a government entity or a commercial entity, but they want to do something to improve the stewardship of this planet that we live on. I think that's a really exciting development. I would encourage you and your families and friends to do that. That's awesome.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Using New Technologies to Create Safe Marine Environments. Our moderator was Rhett Butler, founder and CEO of MongoBray. He also shared with us his experience and what he has been able to accomplish. It's really incredible for each of our speakers what we've heard tonight. Our second speaker is Robin Martin, PhD, Research Associate, Carnegie Institute for Science at Stanford University. Go Stanford. I want you to know I'm going to the Stanford-Notre Dame game. So you know who to cheer for, I hope, right? Joe, I almost missed you in the excitement. Joe Moscardo, Director of Academic Programs, Bay Area Satellite Company Planet, and David Kuzma, Research Director of Global Fishing Watch. This has been an absolutely wonderful panel. Red has done such a terrific job. Let's give them a big applause for all of our speakers. And a big applause and thanks to our terrific audience here on the radio and the internet. And we really encourage you to stay in touch with the Commonwealth Club. Click on commonwealthclub.org for Watch Plus Listen for programs, audio, videotapes, radio schedules, free weekly podcasts, and archives. And look on our green sheet that you received tonight for our fall 2018 programs. Thursday, September 20th, you'll hear from Tom Steemstra and all of his adventures. Wednesday, October 10th, it's John Duval, who's looking at the environmental documentary and environmental activism. Thursday, October 18th, is Stephen Most, Fire and Ice, documentary storytelling and the climate crisis. And Monday, October 29th, we actually have two programs in the same week, so I hope you'll be able to come to both of them. Cole Roberts is going to talk about energy and sustainable businesses, 2 degrees, cities, architects, and our changing environments. And Thursday, October 30, Michael Sutton will be the executive director, Goldman Environmental Foundation, and also Lindsay Allen, executive director of Rainforest Action Network, and research Michael Mantell, president, Research Legacy Fund. And our program will be, what do the midterm elections, our next program will be, do the midterm elections mean for California and the nation? And Rhett will be back for that program. Our final program this fall will be our usual, which is always wonderful, wine tasting event and celebration, which will be November 15. So you'll have a green sheet in front of you. Take one, take more than one, pass them out. Please come to all these wonderful adventures that we have here. Thank you for being here tonight at the Commonwealth Club and in our beautiful building at 110 Embarcadero. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.